M5, the standard. They had an 8. No, I'm wrong. There was two versions of the AM. There was an 8. They had an 8, and then they had a 5, and then they had the 2.1. That was standard for sideband. And then, like you say, the CW was available either in the 500 or the 250. That was the series of filters. I don't think remembering hearing anything else. I would bet you they could go for a very big buck today, Dick, most likely in the hundreds and hundreds of dollars over.
Yeah, the real reason that these Collins mechanical filters existed is that by cutting very exotic SAW slots into a metallic object that sat inside of that cylinder, and by mechanically exciting a very high frequency signal, by mechanical means, you move something at a center frequency of 8.9 megacycles or 455 kilohertz or 4 megacycles. To mechanically move something at megahertz rate is by normal means fairly difficult and exotic. But by putting these SAW slots in this metallic object and precisely cutting them, you set up various modes of resonance so that you were creating an 8-pole, a 10-pole, or a 12-pole filter. In other words, the number of individual resonators that were inside of that filter. These were very high Q, very low loss resonators, where they're all on precise frequencies with precise coupling coefficients between each of these individual resonators. Let me drop. And therefore, by this technique of manufacturing a filter, you've got a large number of poles of very high quality with very precise center frequencies and coupling coefficients. Therefore, you ended up with an extremely repeatable filter with a very desirable passband characteristic when it was plotted on a piece of logarithmic paper representing amplitude vertical and usually linear frequency representing frequency horizontal. You have this beautiful brick wall, rectangular-looking filter, very desirable. Collins mechanical filters are, by modern standards, voluminous, costly, difficult to manufacture by modern-day standards. They were an art form that Collins had perfected from, what was it now, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, is where Collins was located. They had some real experts in Cedar Rapids that could do this work. And nowadays, by way of digital signal processing, you can develop individual resonators in the computer program, which have at least that quality factor and that much control of the coupling coefficients and whatever. You can synthesize that filter passband with digital signal processing today, and you can equal that performance or better that performance, but there's a catch. And the catch is, in order to get that performance with modern day digital signal processing, requires a high performance analog to digital converter on the input end of the filtering process, and the actual computer program is working on signals that have been digitized. And then on the output of the filter, you have a digital-to-analog converter to converting it back. So as long as you've got good control of the amplitude of the signal going in, and you've chosen the correct analog-to-digital and digital-to-analog converters and the right computer program that operates fast enough, you can synthesize that quality today in a very, very small package. That's the good news. The bad news is that if the signal going into that filter is a little bit larger than your design accommodated, and you overload the input analog to digital converter, all of a sudden it has wraparound characteristics, and it's got some nasty distortion characteristics. So you better have a very good, you better have an extremely good automatic gain control circuit that carefully controls the amplitude of the signal going into your DSP. In the case of a mechanical filter, the signal being too small or too large almost didn't matter. With modern day A to D and D to A and D digital signal processing techniques. If the signal is too small, you are undercoupling. You're not using enough of the bits of the dynamic range, and you'll get some artifacts. If you are overloading the signal with too strong, overloading the filter with too strong a signal, you get wraparound characteristics and some nasty distortion. So as long as you're willing to do the rest of the design of the circuit with automatic gain control, with enough dynamic range to it, modern-day DSP and software-defined radios do a better job in a very small package. But there still are people who will listen to a modern-day DSP receiver, they'll listen to an old-fashioned Collins receiver, and they think they can tell the difference. Very similar to modern-day people who are hi-fi enthusiasts will say, I know immediately if that's a tube-type hi-fi amplifier or a transistorized hi-fi amplifier. I can hear the difference. I wonder if you got some opinions on that one, though. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY, even though I embrace, really, love the new technology. There's something to be said about the old technology, and you hit it right on the nail on the head, as they say. If you listen to that Collins receiver, CW on that Collins receiver, it's like music, really, to my ear. It's so comfortable to sit and listen. There's no after ringing in that filter, in the CW mechanical filter. And it's got a lot to be said. In fact, even my transmitter, my Collins transmitter, my Collins KWS1 transmitter, I've got a filter like that, a mechanical filter that's in there for transmitting. So they really pushed it and were able to make an art out of it. Basically, you know, it's, the principle, as you were saying, of that is that the transducers actually used, you were talking about magnetic, I believe they call it what they call magnetostriction, I think that was the word, magnetostriction, magnetostriction, I believe they call that, which converted the electrical signal to a mechanical energy, and then out of the filter back again. You know, it had these little precise metal discs inside the filter, and each one, let me let it drop, I'll say one more word and then we'll go on. Each one of those little discs had a very high Q for a disc. Each one had a disc in there that exceeded a Q of 2,000. So to make a mechanical contrivance like that, that was really, I could say, very impressive. From the first time I ever saw one, heard one, I was impressed. And this has carried over to many people will say that in their modern, brand new transceiver, when they buy the mechanical filter, they have all those DSP and all those other, you know, new type of devices that you can make all kinds of filter arrangements. If you go to getting one of these filters they have that they sell separate, they're costly, and put it in there, they say, gee, what a difference. So that's the story. I think we should go on, Dick.
Yeah, what Mel is responding to.
NY2H.
NY2H recognized. Going to go to you in a second, Lou. NY2H. The Collins mechanical filters had very desirable characteristics when it comes to a transient signal creating ring afterwards. And the way the filter actually worked, they called it a mechanical filter because literally you were shaking something that has the schematic equivalent of a weight on a spring. In other words, it's got a very clearly defined resonant frequency of each one of the resonators inside of that Collins mechanical filter. And now, how do you mechanically excite them? Magnetostriction is one of them. Nickel is one of the magnetostrictive materials. In other words, if I had a bar of nickel and I wrap a solenoid coil of wire around it and put an AC signal and current through that solenoid coil of wire, I'm making and destroying on each half cycle a sinusoidal magnetic field. And nickel is one of the many materials that, microscopically speaking, will change its mechanical length as a function of the instantaneous magnetic field that the nickel rod is experiencing. Therefore, let me drop.
Question.
We're going to go over to Alan in a minute. Therefore, many of the electrostatic, many of the ultrasonic transducers that are on the bottom of this metallic pot, let's say, for instance, you wanted to electronically clean by ultrasonic agitation. You've got some kind of a cleaning fluid in this stainless steel-looking pot, and you put your jewelry in there, and you want to electrostatically clean it. You want to ultrasonically clean it. There is a set of, in some cases, there's a set of nickel rods welded or epoxied to the bottom center of that stainless steel pot, and below the chassis of this ultrasonic cleaner is a coil of wire exciting a magnetic field into those nickel rods, and they're usually skinny little L-shaped rods, and there's a whole lot of them. They're broken up individually to try to lower the amount of eddy current, and that magnetic field changes the physical length of those nickel rods. They are therefore moving the center bottom of the stainless steel container up and down like an oil can, so to speak, microscopically speaking. They're doing it at ultrasonic frequency, and therefore you get some very, very serious cleaning characteristics out of an ultrasonic cleaner. So that's a little bit of what magnetostriction is, and that is one of the excitation techniques for a Collins mechanical filter. I think maybe some of them were also excited piezoelectrically. In other words, a crystal a little bit like a quartz crystal changes its mechanical shape or size as a function of applied voltage. That, again, will mechanically excite the individual resonators in a Collins mechanical filter. KC2RFN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Alan.
KC2RFN. Yeah, this wasn't the question that I was signing in for, but it comes up. It sounds like you're describing something like those memory metals or those muscle wires. Have you heard of those, Dick?
Yeah, there's a kind of wire, niobium. I own a motor made out of this exotic wire that as a function of temperature, it will change shape. And you can make you got a big wheel that's metallic, that's plastic, and a small wheel that's metallic, and this loop of this exotic wire going over it, and you heat up the metallic wheel, and the plastic wheel, the larger one, does the cooling, and the motor will run continuously in one direction when you put this thing in a cup of hot water. So that's a function of temperature. Well, you couldn't make a Collins mechanical filter out of that because you can't change the temperature fast enough. That's one method of these exotic wires. There may be others besides nickel, where magnetostriction takes place, or some other kind of mechanical flexure of the wire takes place as a function of magnetic field. So maybe you're familiar with one of those, Alan. Back to you, Alan. Then we're going to go over to Lou for his comment. Then we're going to go back to you for your question, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I had read an article some years ago about amplifiers that were mechanical amplifiers before the tube was perfected and commercialized. And I'm wondering if this magnetostriction was the basis of its ability to amplify. Was it, or am I way off base?
There definitely were magnetic amplifiers. The SCR-584 radar pedestal, and I, for a short period of time, owned one of those, used a magnetic amplifier. It was a kind of a motor where as you change the magnetic field and the amount of saturation, you change the current from one winding to another, that generated a signal which got fed to a motor. Was the magnetic amplifier, I think the magnetic amplifier looked like a transformer to the uninitiated. It generated a strong or a weak voltage which got sent to the motor, and that changed the motor. The servo motor would move in a certain velocity in a certain direction depending on what the magnetic amplifier is doing. So magnetic amplifiers were done back in the days before really high power tubes were available, and that's a slightly different phenomenon. That was using core saturation characteristics. The DC voltage fed to a transformer that had an AC signal on it, would change the amount of current that the primary winding took as a function of whether or not that transformer core was saturating. Quite possibly Glenn can give us more information on this. But let's find out what Lou had to say on Collins mechanical filters, because I bet you've used a few of those, Lou. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, all. Actually, I was I thought it was a good segue when Mel turned it back to you. It was actually off subject. But let me just a very brief comment, and you can address it or not. And, I was talking to Alan about it also during the week. I guess it was last week we spoke on the TechNet about the NASA announcement about the arsenic displacing phosphorus in the DNA of that particular bacterium. And apparently it was poor science, because now it's being debunked, and it seems like all the peer review happened after the great fanfare and announcement when it hit the Internet. I wonder if you heard about that at all, or what your thoughts might be.
Well, if you listen to the original NASA release that took place on Tuesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they had a so-called naysayer, a man who was throwing cold water on the project. I think he was from the University of Pennsylvania. He expressed his opinions, as well as the lady actually doing the research. And from what I was hearing, she found this bacteria in the Mono Lake in California would live on, naturally was living on an extremely high salty solution. She substituted arsenic for the phosphorus. She saw multiple generations of the bacteria continuing to live and multiply on the arsenic, and when she used mass spectrometry on the bacteria, she found essentially no phosphorus left, but plenty of indication of arsenic, and it appeared that the bacteria was continuing to live and replicate using arsenic as its main, as one of its elements for generating the DNA in substitution for phosphorus. It appeared to be on the assumption that the mass spectrometry was telling her the truth, and there were multiple generations, it seemed to be a significant finding. Now, in order for that to be debunked, they'd have to find out that the bacteria was continuing to use the phosphorus, and that the phosphorus really was present, and it wasn't using the arsenic, and was the mass spectrometry being done incorrectly? Were those measurements lying to her? Give us a couple of words as to your impression of what the debunking was. I mean, if the mass spectrometry was telling the truth, and if that procedure was carried out correctly, and the bacteria was continuing to replicate and live... Replicate and live on multiple generations with essentially no phosphorus left, and the arsenic being used as a substitute. If that measurement was made correctly, then I'm having trouble recognizing how that could be debunked. Now, you could also say, she was saying that if there was a planet that had arsenic but didn't have phosphorus, could DNA life exist? And her point was, at least this showed a mechanism by which it's possible. So which portion of that do you believe got debunked, Lou? NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yeah, NY2H. Apparently the methodology that she used did not... there was some... I'm not going to be able to really explain too much about it. I read it cursory. But it seemed to me that it was the methodology, and that there were other means in which she could have been fooled, and that the arsenic, either the arsenic somehow masked out the phosphorus, I don't really know. But the people that were criticizing it were saying that indeed there was no change in the DNA, but it all had to do with the way the experiment was set up, etc. But I can do my homework, and I can get more specifics on it, and maybe next week give you the particulars. But it just seemed the cart might have been put before the horse here. You know, I'm sure she was well-intended, but, and it's just a little embarrassing that they did make such a, you know, a big fanfare about it, and then it turns out later on that they, well, we'll see. I don't know if it's definitively decided, but it seems to be that the great majority of accomplished people in the field, are saying it really isn't the way it was presented. And from the article I read, there were about maybe three people who were more like editorial review people, more like publishing types.
Not quite sure if you handed it back to me, Lou. You stopped in mid-sentence, and maybe you timed out your particular link. And I think you're coming in by a internet technique, and you're one of the few people who have the audio volume set correctly if you're coming in by an internet technique. Quite often people have the volume much too high or much too low or distorted, and you've got it just right. Kind of curious how you did that. And by the way, even if an error is discovered, there's a hell of a lot of pieces of science where an error is discovered. That in itself is not embarrassing. You could say real science has more errors than non-errors. That's the nature of doing research. And by the peer review process, by other people looking at your work and finding those errors, you come to the conclusion of a higher truth. By my standards, the only true thing to be embarrassed about when doing science is you yourself did something that is truly a lie. In other words, you've got data saying that what you're claiming is absolutely not true, and you're just not revealing that data, and you hope that no one else discovers the error. If you're truly lying, and withholding data and using subjectivity in the way you report the evidence, then there's true embarrassment taking place. But for her to make a sincere investigation, telling you exactly how she did it so that other people in other laboratories can duplicate it, and if an error is discovered in the peer review process, to me that's not embarrassing. That's the way science works. You might have an opinion on that, Lou. And Lou, what did you do to make your audio on your internet connection so well done? It sounds good. NY2H, K2RIW, hope other people can do it.
A1FC.
FC recognized, but Lou first. Go ahead, Lou.
Yeah, okay, Dick, very fine. I'm on Echolink, actually, on my Android Evo Sprint phone. So that's really what that's about. In fact, it dropped connection. I got a little concerned there, but I had to disconnect and reconnect, and I heard you on there. I think everybody on the Echolink got dropped because there were about six people, and I came back, and no one was there, so it must have been a burp. But no, the embarrassing part, I think, it was not on her part, and as I said before, I believe she's well-intended. The embarrassing part is that all the peer review was done before the fanfare, and you know, it's more the administrative embarrassment, I think, than the scientific embarrassment. No, I don't think there's any, you know, chicanery or deception. And so that's basically, you know, my thoughts on that. So that's all. That's all I have. So back to NY2H.
One other quick question, Fred. What did you do to get the audio set just right? Because most people, using other means of coming in as, Echolink. Okay, even with Echolink, you got the audio set just right. What process did you do that, and how come so many other people are unsuccessful in getting the audio level set just right? Back to you on that one, Lou.
Okay, well, you know, I have a laptop, and sometimes I'll go on Echolink on that, and that's got a cheap microphone, and it's really crappy audio. But this particular phone, this is the Sprint. It's made by HTC Evo, and there is an adjustment that Jonathan has here for the audio level. And basically, as you know, Echolink has a test server. So I think I brought it up to plus 6 dB. It goes anywhere from in the minus ranges through zero and into some of the plus ranges. And plus DB just seemed to sound the best in terms of the Echo test server. So that's what I did. Back to you.
Well done, Lou. Fred, K1FC, those guys in Stamford, you got to get up pretty early in the morning to put something over, to pull something on them. So quite possibly you know more about the so-called situation with NASA and what really took place. K1FC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, actually, I was just going to comment that most fields of science, the at least 60% of initial papers on any on anything turn out eventually to be incorrect. And I do agree with Lou. The problem in this case was that NASA kind of tried to short-circuit the normal peer review process. The issue is that didn't replace all the phosphorus, and there are a lot of issues concerning bond length and whatnot when you try to substitute a partial substitution of arsenic in, because the bond length is slightly different than you have a cumulative effect when you're talking about DNA, and that's why there's a bunch of issues. It's extreme. If you want to get into the science, it's extremely complex, however. And so much for my comment. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago, I found this little saying that was in Newsday, the December 2nd issue, under the CryptoQuote, and it was that this guy named Hugh Walpole made a statement way back in the Dark Ages where he said, "In all science, error precedes the truth, and it is better it should go first than last." Now, if in what you recognize, Fred, not all of the arsenic was replaced by, not all of the phosphorus was replaced with arsenic, if there was, let me pick a number, 5% arsenic, 5% phosphor left, and 95% of the DNA was using arsenic, and if the arsenic DNA was viable and was able to replicate, then that wouldn't bother me. Is that what they were saying? That some percentage of the phosphorus was still there? Or were they saying that all of the viable DNA was only using phosphorus and that none of the DNA used arsenic, or that the arsenic DNA was not viable for replication? Which do you think was being said, Fred? K1FC, K2RIW in the TechNet?
My understanding was is that there was only a partial replacement, and my recollection, I did read some back and forth in one of the tech blogs on bond lengths and all that, and how this is a small percentage in the difference of the bond length between the two, that a small percentage of replacement pulls apart the DNA, that things don't end up coming out even. And that's why a lot of people were concerned about the finding that there was a partial replacement, and how much of a replacement can you do and still maintain the DNA as a stable, in a stable form. Anyhow, I've just pulled in my driveway, so I'll say 73. This is K1FC. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Fred, and thank you for checking in. We'll eventually find out what happens. I guess my major question is, was the DNA made with arsenic, was it viable? Was it capable of replication? If not, then yes, that is not a living organism, by my standards, with arsenic substituting for phosphorus. In a matter of time, we'll find out exactly what happened. Very similar to NASA's announcement that they found this rock in the Antarctic, which they believe came from Mars, and the rock appeared to contain the living mechanisms in fossilized form. And so it would be a piece of evidence suggesting that life once existed on Mars. By way of spirit and opportunity, we now have a tremendous amount of evidence that running water at one time did exist on Mars, and therefore life of some form could easily have formed on Mars way back in the Dark Ages. Let's see now, Alan was the next person on our list, KC2RFN. Go ahead with your real question, Alan. And I wonder if you're going to be involved in the repeat procedure. You may have heard that another award with reference to what you initiated is going to be issued at Ham Radio University. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2RFN. No, I didn't know that, so I may ask you for that speech back, Dick, so I can give it for you again. And richly deserved, too. TechNet's an excellent place. And everything that's discussed, even though a lot of it does fall outside of my orbit, so there's almost no discussions here. I don't get something out of it, at the very least terminology, phraseology, that sort of thing. And makes the hobby much more interesting. It makes the hobby of science that much more interesting. As far as this life form that's using arsenic, it's kind of like cold fusion. I'd like to see a lot more information. Like I said last week, I think it's pretty ho-hum until more information comes out. So, putting it up on the shelf for now. But here's my question. Let me drop. You're focusing a little bit more in the magnetic domain as opposed to electric domain, and that's interesting. We've been doing that the past few weeks, and I've been thinking, you were talking about how broadcast AM radio was utilizing, for a reason I've forgotten, so I'm asking here again, it's using the H-field by use of a coil wrapped around a ferrite bar to pick up the signal and then send it on through the radio. But why is that chosen over the E field? In other words, why was the H field more advantageous than the E field for that application? And of course, in my house, the practical application of this is I like to listen to WABC, which is broadcast from New York City, and on Long Island, on my first floor and second floor, it's a very noisy signal. The direction of the radio is very important, and I'd like to be able to improve my reception if possible. And today I went upstairs and tuned my ham radio into the broadcast band, and I was listening to ABC rather clearly, but I'm doing it through my dipole. So my question is, does my ham radio, is it listening to the E-field and then processing that AM, or is it does my radio have one of those coil-wrapped ferrite bars in it? And the other question is, can I build a big coil to get a better reception on regular AM radio at, say, my kitchen?
Yeah, Don, good set of questions, Alan. And a lot of this is my recent opinion. So until it gets more peer-reviewed, consider it a hypothesis, and I'm going to tell you the origin of my hypothesis. Back in the early days of when Mel and I were cutting our teeth, the AM radio in automobiles consisted of a whip antenna on usually the forward left fender of the car. The whip antenna was about 2.5 feet long. You pulled it out, and it gave you reasonably good AM reception with one catch. Walk up to that AM radio, unless you were 5 miles away from the broadcast station, walk up to the AM radio and touch that piece of whip antenna, and essentially all radio reception stopped. That's clue number one. You could tell that it's a very tenuous receiving system. Number two, on a snowy day, when snow was piled around the base of that AM whip antenna, until you wiped away the snow, the AM signal didn't come through, unless, again, you were right next door to the broadcast station. So you can tell that the reception would easily be attenuated by, let me pick a number, 60 decibels, if you simply touched it, or if there was some wet snow, spaced at the bottom of the antenna. Now let's look at the wavelength-wise. If I'm listening to a frequency in the middle of the AM band, let me drop, 1 megacycle. One megacycle, by definition, is extremely close to a 300-meter wavelength, 984 feet. So the wavelength you're listening to of a one megacycle AM radio is 984 feet. That little whip antenna you've got there, 2.5 feet long, is 0.25% of a wavelength, a quarter of 1% of a wavelength. It likes to be a quarter wave. So what are you going to do? You're going to electronically resonate it. And how do they do that? If you actually study the coax cable that came out of your AM radio Fender antenna and traversed over to the actual radio itself, you'd see it was an extremely fine piece of wire with air as the insulation into a piece of coax, but it was a little bit larger in diameter than RG6. It was 95-ohm coax cable, and it went into an AM tuning circuit that had to be very carefully tracked. If you got the tracking a little bit wrong on your car radio, that signal would go down real fast. So it was an extremely high impedance antenna, because I've been saying for a long time, you can make an antenna any length in the world. How you impedance match it is the next thing you've got to worry about. You make an antenna that's a quarter of 1% long as a ground plane antenna instead of a quarter wavelength long. Your feed impedance is, let me pick a number, probably 5,000 or 10,000 ohms of capacitive reactance, and you've got to resonate that. And the resistive component is probably something in the vicinity of a quarter of 1 ohm. So in other words, the impedance matching of that antenna is very difficult, and unless you do it just right, the efficiency goes to hell in a handbasket real fast. Let me drop. The magic of radio is that the signal that's really transmitted in the air has a very predictable amount of E field and H field for free space propagation. The H field reception, if you decide, and by the way, that antenna, that 0.25% long whip antenna, is sensing the E field. You could, with modern day transistors, with a much smaller antenna, into a 10 megohm input impedance field effect transistor, which didn't exist in those days, you could make a small antenna with field effect transistor that, as long as it was well insulated from ground, you put it inside of the right kind of a radome, make sure that no snow can go nearby, make sure that no hand can touch it. With modern day E field effect transistors with extremely high input impedance, I could get E field reception. But that kind of a technique in those days didn't exist. So now, what did exist in those days is H-field sensing devices. A magnetic coil, a ferrite coil, can easily pick up the H-field, and it's nowhere near as sensitive. You can put your hand on that ferrite rod, and for all practical purposes, nothing happens. Instead of the signal disappearing by 60 decibels when you touch the whip, you touch that ferrite rod, and the signal goes down 2 dB. H-field is a lot less sensitive because of just the characteristics it's got. So an H-field rod sensing antenna with ferrite allows you to make an extremely tiny antenna. In the case of an automobile, an E-field antenna with that 2.5-foot whip is a moderate performance antenna. Imagine trying to put that into a handheld transistorized radio. Attempts were made. Without modern-day FETs, you wouldn't succeed. You've got too little ground plane, too little radiator. The feed impedance would be 40,000 ohms, so to speak, and impedance matching it in those days with the available transistors would have been very difficult. This gives you a little bit of a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So instead of trying to pick up the E field, you decide that I am going to use this other technique of available components that I've got, a ferrite rod, and I pick up the H field. It is much less sensitive. The impedance matching becomes a lot easier. The tuning characteristics are nowhere near as severe. And so when it comes to frequencies, let me pick a number. Below 10 megacycles, if you've got the right materials and you want to make an H-field sensing antenna instead of an E-field sensing antenna, the technology exists there for you to do it. And as you go down to even lower frequencies, like these 150 kilohertz signals that are transmitted every so often from Scandinavia, there, an E-field antenna is almost out of the question. The actual antenna that they use for transmitting is a fraction of a mile long, and the thing is on 450-foot-high towers, and it's a great big structure. Now, that's a good transmitting antenna, and if you had the resources and you built a similar receiving antenna, it would work like a charm. But you and I don't want to spend the resources to do that. To make a simple coil of wire and resonate it and properly orient it so it picks up the H field is a very easy thing for you and I to do. I could wrap a coil of wire in a 1 foot diameter with the right number of turns, I resonate it, I properly orient it, put it into a reasonably low noise receiver at 150 kilohertz, and I'm going to get extremely good reception of that 150 kilohertz signal transmitted from Scandinavia. Maybe that helps a little bit. KC2 RFN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very much so. Well, with that being the case, is it worthwhile building an H-field antenna for receiving for, say, 3 to 30 megahertz for the ham band?
Oh, boy, you came to the right place. For the last 3, 4, 5 years, a guy named K2KEY has done just that. He's made a simple coil of wire without the ferrite. Didn't even bother putting the ferrite in there. A simple coil of wire that sits in the shack with him. He resonates it because it is a couple of square feet of material on a wooden platform, and he's got it on something like a tripod, and he can change its azimuth and its elevation orientation so that he can favor the right direction of arrival, and he can favor the right polarization of the 80-meter and 40-meter and 160-meter signals that Mel listens to, and he gets better signal-to-noise ratio reception on that simple loop antenna in the shack with him compared to this behemoth in the backyard of 270 feet of full-wave loop antenna 35 or 40 feet in the air, fed with open wire line, an extremely low-loss antenna, and he compares that loop in the shack. There are times when he gets considerably better reception. He hasn't yet transmitted through it, but that's another whole series of experiments. Let me turn it over to Mel to give us some words on this. I bet you've had some very desirable characteristics out of that simple loop antenna, properly oriented in the shack with you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
And KC2QIQ with a comment?
You're going to be right up to Mel. Go ahead, Mel.
Yes, basically described. Well, it's been fairly well described. I mean, I'm not going to claim that I did any pioneering work in it other than was, you know, very amazed at how it works. If you look in the antenna issue, the ARRL antenna issue on receiving antennas, you'll see this thing. They have one, in fact, there they have one for 160. I built the one for 80 meters, which actually is, 12 feet in a square. As Dick says, it sits on a tripod. You resonate it, and it is a peak. I mean, it peaks amazing. And as Dick says, if you go ahead and you tilt this thing, I keep it in one position, I turn it. In fact, sometimes what I do is I use it for my noise sensing device. I have a sensor system on 80 meters. Sometimes the noise level gets, you know, atrocious. So what I do is I actually turn this antenna, peak it to the noise source, tilt it or whatever I have to do to get the noise source peaked. I then run it through a QR Nancy squasher combined with the regular received signal. And it's amazing. I can phase out, say, noises, sometimes noise 5, 10 over S9, and bring it down to a reasonable level, sometimes like S5. So it's quite something, and just a marvel what you can really do by very simple methods. Back to you, Dick.
Are you saying that's in the ARRL antenna handbook, Mel?
Exactly. It's in the book. You'll see a young lady standing there holding one.
Mel, on a really good day, roughly how many decibels of better signal-to-noise ratio have you occasionally been able to get on the simple loop antenna on reception in the shack with you compared to the great big behemoth in the backyard, your 270 feet of full-wave loop antenna? When you compare signal-to-noise ratio of antenna in the backyard versus the loop in the shack with you, when you're not peaking for noise, you're peaking for signal. Have there been times when the loop in the shack gave you better signal-to-noise ratio? And make me a rough guess. 3 dB better? 6 dB better? K2KEY? K2RIW?
Let's say 6 dB, next unit. Oh, yes. Easily. 10 dB, I would bet. I've had that. Definitely. As I say, what you see sometimes, basically, if you read last month's issue of QST, you see there's more going on. We always talk basically about things like a Doppler shift and a Faraday rotation and things like that. But there's more going on here, that there are times when you are, I may not be even peaking the antenna at times when I am getting better results. You just got to play with it and see what it'll do. Put it on a tripod, you make it so, like you say, so you can turn it, you can tilt it, you can do all kinds of maneuvers with it, and I'll tell you, there does not seem to be a rule of thumb what will work tonight to the same station tomorrow. It's could be a whole different situation, but it's just, you sit there and marvel. Go ahead, Dick.
And think about this, Mel, and Alan, that simple loop antenna in the shack with him gives him the freedom to change the orientation on that tripod so he can favor the right azimuth, the right elevation, and the right polarization. But he has a simple flat loop antenna, linear polarized H-field receiving antenna. By way of that article that was in the last issue of QST, the December issue, where we talk about the HAWP system, which does ionospheric sounding and whatever, and the fact that the ionosphere in general will take your linear transmitted signal and make it elliptically polarized in almost all cases. And what Mel is doing when he peaks that antenna is he is peaking it for the maximum axis of elliptical polarization, the A minus B, if you know what I mean, of the ellipse. There's a major axis and there's a minor axis of the ellipse, and he's peaking for the major axis, and he's only looking at the linear component. If he went the next step, and if that loop antenna in the shack with him was two separate loops at right angles to each other, and he could adjust the amplitude and the phase angle between the two for reception so that he could peak the elliptical polarization, he's going to get another step of improvement in signal-to-noise ratio. This is a whole area that has not been investigated. It's a fine... Let me drop.
Dick, I have that.
Oh. So, in general, it defies common sense. Whenever he tells his buddies that the simple loop in the shack with him, on certain occasions and many, a lot of occasions, is giving him a better signal-to-noise ratio than the behemoth in the backyard well assembled with good materials. Of course, they say, hey, you're crazy. Huh? If you understand what signal-to-noise ratio on HF frequencies really means, where you peak the characteristics of the signal, irrespective of the noise, and peak azimuth, elevation, and polarization, you can come out way ahead. So are you telling me you have already experimented with some right-angle loop antennas in the shack, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
I thought I'd mention it. I'll describe this. Well, first of all, I made a wooden frame. It's not a complicated, this thing is not, something that you say, hard to duplicate. Very easy. You just take, I made a wooden frame. I went to Home Depot, bought wood, square wood. Well, it's not really square. I think it's half, it's 1 inch wide by about, I think, half inch thick, the wood. Like it's, I don't know what they use it for. I guess it's for trimming. I bought some strips of that. I cut it up and I made myself a frame. Picture a frame 3 foot on a side. Nice square frame. I then mounted it. I made a mounting up for it so it could sit in a diamond shape. So it looks like if you, like a baseball diamond. Where home plate is down where it mounts onto the tripod. And there's the variable capacitor. I stretched the wire, the coax cable, with the split end, the split end would be like where second base is. And then inside of it, I made another one to fit inside, and it pivots. I just made a simple thing with wood dowel, piece of wood dowel, and then I just reduplicated it, and with wood dowel, and also pivot, you know, so it could pivot inside, turn and pivot independently of the other one. And it's fun just to see what they do, how they interact with each other over.
Wow. With that inner H-field coil being used simultaneously with the outer H-field coil, when you added that extra embodiment, which I think is not part of the original ARRL antenna handbook suggestion. This is a Schneider edition, as I understand it, Mel. Give me a rough guess on a good day what improvement in performance the inner coil gave you when you properly oriented with the outer coil. K2KEY, K2LIW.
As I say, it could be very amazing. You can listen to that band and say, I'll give up tonight. The noise level is 20 over 9. I mean, that's not unusual to hear on 80 meters, especially on the 75-meter portion of the phone band. You go to the 80 meters CW, like you say, you get down to very narrow filters. You know, you can dig out some very weak signals because the selectivity is so much improved with listening to CW, say, with a 200-hertz filter or even less. Go down to a 50-hertz filter. But when it comes to phone, you know, to make sense of what you're listening to, you've got to do something else. You just got to some way figure out how the heck you get rid of some of this noise. So when you get this thing, you play with this, tilting it, bending it. Fortunately, sometimes the QSO is almost over by the time you get the thing sounding, you know, decent. Or, you know, making a copy on a signal. But if it's a nice, long QSO and all, I'll play around and I'll get the thing. And it's amazing because if I put it back to bypass, back just to the loop, there's, like I say, it's a noise level that's mind-boggling. And I'll bring it down. Conservatively, I'll say at least 10 dB. Over.
Fantastic. There's a whole area of research there that hasn't been very much tapped into. And that article in the last issue of QST is giving us some strong hints, and you've got some hands-on evidence that there's a lot more to be gleaned out of this one, Mel. Glenn, KC2QIQ, I wonder if you've done some magnetic antenna reception characteristics. You got it, Glenn.
It's funny that you mentioned that, Dick, because you'd think that I probably would have, but actually I really haven't. But I wanted to bring up an interesting little thing. You know, one, with the antenna that Mel has, that it's basically, like you're saying, it does have the magnetic properties, but it also is kind of an interesting antenna that it also has a high Q property with it as well. Very, very narrow band. And, you know, because you're kind of getting that pre-selector effect with the tunable C with the L. So there's kind of like a mixed match of things that are going on there that make that antenna very interesting. It's, you know, it's not really like just the basic H-field antenna. Let me let it drop for a second. Another antenna that I have never made, and I've been trying to analyze it for the longest period of time, and I've had some results in it, but I don't quite understand it yet, is most everybody who has these new little handheld scanners, Radio Shack, a whole bunch of these other ones, basically, they've got coverage. They'll cover from 50 megahertz all the way up into like 800 megahertz. And the antenna is about 6 inches long. And what's fascinating about it is it does have H-field properties to it because, like you said, you can touch it with your hand and it almost has no effect on it whatsoever. The reception at 50 megahertz all the way to 800 megahertz is phenomenal. And, I try to put the antenna onto an analyzer, and it just looks like horrible garbage. But then again, if I put any other type of antenna on the scanner, it just doesn't perform. It'll maybe cover a very narrow bandwidth. But this little 6-inch antenna, so there's something going on there as well. I was wondering if you'd have any insight on those little scanner antennas, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, your last question has got two areas of research there, or questioning, Glenn. Let me go to the first one first. You speculated that loop antenna that Mel is using is an extremely high Q structure. And if your definition of high Q is that when he tunes the loop to, let's say, 3.75 megacycles, the outer big loop to 3.75 megacycles, I will admit that it probably has a huge number of decibels of rejection of a strong signal at, say, for instance, twice the frequency at roughly 7 megacycles, or at half the frequency, somewhere in the 160 meter band. Huge rejection. But when it comes to how broadband and how high Q it is at 3.75, Mel, give me a rough guess. When you tune it to 3.75, the antenna, and don't touch the tuning of the antenna. You're only using the larger outer loop antenna for reception. And maybe you're listening to noise, or maybe you're listening to signals, and you take the receiver dial and simply go up and down in frequency. Roughly how far have you got to go before the antenna falls off significantly? Let's find out what the Q of the outer loop all by itself is before you retune it. What's your guess on that one, Mel? Give me rough ballpark. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, the Q of an antenna like this, remember, it has certain constraints. Let's talk about the constraints of the antenna. First of all, you got to realize that the antenna has to fit a certain number of physics. It must be not exceed 0.1 wavelength. That's the physics of it. Now, the inductance of the loop I measured was somewhere, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 microhenry. So that, what would be the Q, you know? I'll tell you, it's very sharp tuning. That I will say. And, what would I guess at the Q? Well, I could, I'd have to really figure out really what the Q is, but I'll tell you one thing. It does exhibit approximately at least, I'd say, now if you talk about peaking it, it does show at least like a 30 dB of front-to-side response, Dick. As far as the exact Q, let me see if I can come up with some idea, you know. Good question. What would be the Q of an antenna like this? Over.
Okay, front-to-side rejection is antenna pattern that's not necessarily Q. Assuming you're correct at 15 microhenries, 15 microhenries of inductance of that antenna at 3.75 megacycles would be an inductive reactance of 348, 349 ohms. Very reasonable number. And you and I can easily figure out how many picofarad of capacitance across that is going to resonate it. And then impedance matching it is another minor problem. I'm going to guess that you can take that antenna without retuning the antenna and tune your receiver 40 kilohertz up or 40 kilohertz down before the signal falls off real far. That's a pure guess on my part, and you're going to say, no, I can only tune 2KC, or no, I can tune 400KC. You're going to tell me that one pretty soon. Also, to get 15 microhenries on this 3-foot by 3-foot wooden slat frame, how many turns are in there, Mel? Is that just one turn for the 15 microhenries? I should know and I don't know. So question number two is how many turns, but question number one, what's your gut feel? Can you tune 15 or 50KC up the band without retuning the antenna before it falls off a whole lot of dBs? K2KEY, K2RIW?
No, nowhere near that. I think I can go maybe 15. Yeah, maybe I think 15 kilohertz either side of its tuned spot. Just about. So let's say it may have 25 to 30 kilohertz of bandwidth before it's really pronounced. It drops off fairly quick, I'll tell you. No, I'll tell you what I did.
you know, it's a little bit of a science, a little bit of mathematics involved in putting something like this together. Because you got to realize the cable that just like, remember, it's cable. The coax cable, it's a shielded loop, remember? So the capacitance of the cable I used was like, I think I measured like, was like 20 picofarads.